would ask that you'd turn to the passage that I read this morning, which is Luke chapter 1, beginning at verse 5. If you don't, it's not a bad thing. You're not going to be judged. But I would hope that in the future, maybe you could begin to bring a Bible, or I think it'd be a good thing for us to actually have the text in our hand. And if you don't have a Bible, there are some Bibles scattered around. Where they are, I have no idea. So if you find one, good luck. But I'd like to just walk through this passage with you and look at a few key verses and then talk about how they apply. If you look at Luke chapter 1, verse 6, it says, "And they were both righteous before God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and statutes of the Lord. But they had no child because Elizabeth was barren and they were advanced in years." Well, Zechariah and Elizabeth were good people. They obeyed the moral and the spiritual laws of God as revealed in the Ten Commandments and the Torah. They went to the annual pilgrimage to Jerusalem, which is no small thing. They went to Sabbath. They obeyed the ceremonial law. I mean, these were people who were zealous to do what God wanted. But even with that zealousness for God's law, they still did not experience all the blessings that other people did. It says that she was barren. They suffered. You think what it must have been like for them. You know, they're a young married couple, you know, maybe married at 13 or 15 or 17 back in those days. And other friends of theirs begin to get married, and they rejoice in seeing their, you know, friends finding the loves of their life and all this stuff similar to us. And then eventually, you know, the news comes that one of them is pregnant. And so they rejoice that their friends are pregnant. And then after a little while, they, you know, start to get excited because they start to see the body getting bigger. I'm treading on very gentle ground here. So, but they start to get excited about the baby coming, and they maybe even have a party like we do. And I don't know that they have a bridal shower, a Target, or whatever, you know, they do, or what do they call that thing where they registry? There we go. Thank you. And then they have a bridal shower, whatever they do. But there is this excitement and anticipation, and eventually the baby comes and they rejoice. And then eventually their friends begin to have children, but they have no child. And they're thinking, well, how can this be? I mean, we obey the Lord's commandments and we do the best we can, but still we have this problem. Well, after a little while, you know, the kids get older and the kids go off and gain their own independence. And eventually the kids have their kids. And so their friends are now grandparents, and they're rejoicing in their grandsons and granddaughters. And Elizabeth and Zechariah are standing there and are saying, "Lord, where are you in all this mess? Don't we obey you? Aren't we righteous?" So good people suffer. But in verse 13, you can see the angel came and he said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear a son. You'll call his name John, and you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth." Well, Zechariah had struggled with God, like probably Elizabeth had, with his provision of a son. But this struggle had brought him to pray. And God had heard and answered those prayers faithfully. Those answers to prayers were going to produce what he said would be joy and gladness for Zechariah and Elizabeth, and blessing to other people. And so Zechariah says to the angel in verse 18, "Well, how can I know this from an old man, and my wife is advanced in years?" That question, "How can I know this?" It seems very innocuous and it seems to not be offensive. But you think about it. And he said, really, you know, I'm looking at my circumstances. I'm looking at my life and I don't see any way this will happen. And even though there's an angel standing in front of me at the altar of God, I'm still questioning, Lord, who you are. He was old. His wife was probably through menopause and he was looking at his circumstances. But he wasn't looking at God. Well, the angel answered him in verse 19 and said, "I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I was sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. You can imagine kind of Gabriel steps back and he said, I'd like to review the facts with you, Zechariah. My name, let me just reintroduce myself, is Gabriel, and I stand in the presence of God in heaven. And I stand with angels and archangels and all the company of heaven and elders and, you know, four-eyed this and, you know, four-legged that. And, you know, and by the way, I was one of the warriors who threw down Satan, you know. And he stands and says, this is who I am. And I was commissioned by God as God's servant. I speak as an angel with the authority of God. In Zechariah, by the way, I was sent to you. I was sent to you here in this room. And the message to you was one of good news, not just for you, but for the world. But it was a message of good news, of joy and of gladness for you. It was deeply personal. And he says in verse 20, so behold, you'll be silent. You need a sign because you don't trust. Here's a sign. You'll be silent. And you'll be unable to speak until that day that these things take place, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time. Gabriel confronts and he punishes Zechariah for doubting his words, God's words. Zechariah was doubting God. Well, what might God be saying to us through this passage? And I believe there are four very powerful promises that I need to hear and that perhaps you need to hear. The first promise is in Luke 1:11. And that is the promise that God broke into Zechariah's life. And I believe with you that God will break into ours. You know, we all come this morning. We have different needs. Robin and I are in this strained situation. Her and the kids are living in Durham, North Carolina. I'm coming up here 5 days a week and living with Danny Huffman, who's a friend of Jim Sally's, and I'm kind of got this, you know, room and stuff. But it's hard to be away from Robin and the kids, and it's hard for them to be away from me, I think. It seems like. And we're eager to move here, but, you know, we have challenges to our faith in God that he'll sell our house. I mean, that's my challenge, you know. It's a hard market to sell a house. Let's just put it that way. Perhaps some of you are here. Maybe you're single. You're waiting for the right person to marry. And you have a hard time believing that God will have that person. So you're challenged to wait and to wait for that right person. Maybe you're waiting for money. You're waiting for a better car that won't break down. I don't know what it is you're waiting for. Maybe we're waiting for healing for ourselves. We're waiting for God to touch us physically or emotionally or spiritually or relationally. We're wanting healing for ourselves or for a spouse who we want help with. Maybe we are burdened for a friend who's going through a really tough time. We're waiting. And finally, maybe you're like Israel. You've been waiting for so long and you feel so spiritually dry that you despair. In the book of 2 Peter chapter 3, God had inspired Peter to write these words. Do not forget this one thing, my dear friends. With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like a day. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. And again in Hebrew, and I love this verse, taken from the Living Bible, God have mercy on us all. That's a joke. It actually has some good contributions. I don't know where that came from. Hebrews chapter 6, verse 9. For God, and listen to this, it's so, so good. Hebrews chapter 6, verse 9. For God is not unfair. How can he forget your hard work for him? Or forget the way you used to show your love for him and still do by helping his children? God also bound himself with an oath, so that those he promised to help would be perfectly sure and never need to wonder whether or not he might change his plans. He has given us both a promise and an oath. Two things we can totally count on, for it's impossible for God to tell a lie. Now all those who flee to him to save them can take new courage when they hear such assurances from God. Now they can know without a doubt that he will give him the salvation that he has promised them. And that's not just eternal salvation. That is working out our salvation. That is the strength and the power and the grace and the encouragement while we wait. This certain hope of being saved and saved and saved is a strong and trustworthy anchor for our souls, connecting us with God himself. So where are we this morning with God in regards to breaking into our lives? Are we passionate to see him, or are we not passionate? I love the candor that we can express to God and say, God, honestly, I don't trust you. I don't want you. I'm dry, but I need you, and I want you, and I want to trust you. I pray with you, and I believe with you in God's faithfulness, his very personal faithfulness to you. Well, secondly, God heard Zechariah's prayers, and the second promise is that he will hear ours. Jeremiah 29:11 says, "For I know the plans that I have for you and for you and for you. Plans of welfare, not for calamity, to give you a future and to give you a hope. And then you will call on me and I will come to you. And then when I come to you, you will listen to me. For you will seek me and you'll find me when you search for me with all of your heart, and I will come to you and you will listen to me." I felt impressed to remind us this morning that Satan's strategy in our lives is very much the same as a military strategy. And there are two main components that I've seen over the last 14 years and about 7 days here at the River in ministry. And that is that he is to isolate and he is to cut off communications, just like we do as a military. We divide and conquer, but we also make sure to take out their satellite systems and so they can't communicate with one another. So what he wants to do, Satan, in your life is to tell you that what you're going through, no one can understand. What sin you've committed, no one would ever commit. The doubt that you have, no other people have. They're living much better Christian lives than you are. You're not the person you're supposed to be, and no one could ever understand you. In fact, if you shared who you were and where you were, you'd probably get rejected, maybe even publicly, right? So he wants to isolate you. But secondly, he wants to cut off communications. Satan knows that when you expose where you are to other people, when you expose the secrecy of your life and the hiddenness and the things that you struggle with and that you're ashamed by, that he's lost. And so in James chapter 5, it says, "Confess your sins to one another and pray for one another that you might be healed." Listen, I've been to too many churches and I've been in too many communities where people were walking around and they're pretending and they're isolated and they're just doing the church thing, but they're really not in community with one another. And I would dare to say that our vision for this place is not to be that kind of a place. Okay? So remember Satan's strategy. Have you the faith, like Zechariah, to pray? And instead of getting bitter at God while we wait, to get broken and to go to God and to one another. And thirdly, God has joy and gladness prepared for us, as well as fruitful kingdom work. Look at the angel's promise to Zechariah. He was going to be a son, and this was going to be a son of joy and a son of gladness. Do you think that God doesn't know that we should enjoy and be glad for the things of our life? We're not dualists, right? We're not the people who say, well, you know, spirit is good and body is bad. You know, football is bad and prayer is good. You know, going to church is good and enjoying a good hike is bad. That's not who we are. John Calvin had an incredibly developed theology that maybe we'll look at over time, where all of life was meant to be enjoyed. And everything in its proper place was meant to be enjoyed. So whether it's temporal things, material possessions, family and friends, all that was to be enjoyed. Whether it was influence, the influence that we have on friends, the influence that we have at work, all those are good things, as long as it doesn't become power. And our materialism, as long as it doesn't become greed. And our sensuality and our sexuality, as long as it doesn't become lust. All those things are to be enjoyed. Some pretend as if God is surprised or even offended when people of faith enjoy the things of creation. And I think that's really sad. But God has also given us fruitful kingdom work. And God had given John fruitful kingdom work. Look at the list that God laid forward for what John would be. It reminded me of Isaiah 61, 1 through 3. In many ways, I would say if I wanted for us to have some marching orders as a church, it would be Isaiah 61, 1 to 3. And the type of person that I would hope we would all be becoming is a person who can say, the Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me and it's on you. Because the Lord has given us His Holy Spirit and He's anointed us to preach good news to the poor, to those without. He sent me to bind up those with broken hearts, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release from the darkness for prisoners, to proclaim this is the year, this is the day, this is the time for God's favor, and the day of vengeance of our God on the injustices of this world, social, spiritual, and otherwise. To comfort all who mourn, to provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair, because there are so many people in despair. Then they, you and me, and they will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of His splendor. I believe for you and I believe for me of this third promise that God has given us joy and gladness, but also fruitful kingdom work. For no eye has seen, no ear has heard, not entered into the mind of man what God has conceived for those who love Him. Well, finally, God has given you and me a choice of how to respond to Him. Zechariah, remember, looked at his circumstances. He looked at himself. He looked at his situation. He did not look at God. God promised John, and he questioned. You and me can easily doubt and not trust. We can easily despair and not pray. It reminded me of the life of Horatio Spafford. Horatio Spafford was a successful Chicago lawyer and a friend of Dwight Moody. So he was in those kind of circles. Spafford had invested heavily in real estate, but the fire of 1871 wiped out his holdings, and his son died shortly thereafter. Again, this is the 1870s. Spafford and his family desperately needed to rest, so he planned a trip to Europe with his wife and four daughters. While in Great Britain, he hoped to help Moody and Sankey with their evangelistic tour, but last minute, so he was a man of God. He was much like Elizabeth, and he was much like Zechariah. But last minute, business caused him to delay his departure, but he sent his wife and four daughters on the SS Ville du Havre as scheduled, promising to follow in a few days. On November 22, the ship was struck, and it sank. Several days later, the survivors landed at Wales, and Mrs. Spafford cabled and sent her husband the message, saved alone. When Horatio Spafford made the ocean crossing to meet his wife, he sailed near the place where his four daughters sunk. Sorry. And there in the midst of his sorrow, he wrote these unforgettable words, "When peace like a river attendeth my way. When sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, Lord, you have taught me to say, it is well with my soul. And though Satan should buffet and trials should come, let this blessed assurance control, that Christ has regarded my helpless estate and has shed his own blood for my soul. Well, right now, God is breaking in. What we've heard from today, hopefully from God, is more of an initiation on his behalf to reintroduce himself to you and to me. And this great promise of God, the greatest one, is really this silhouette that we see behind the cradle. Behind the cradle is a cross. And it reminds us that God became flesh in order to live the life that we could not live and to die a death of which we could not pay. He was born to die. God does not want us this morning to grab hold of him. He does not want us because we cannot do it. In actuality, he wants us to die, to drop our plans for what we have in our future, our attempts to be perfect, our hiding in the garden, our attempting to cover ourselves with leaves and garments that never cover. What he wants this morning is to fulfill these promises to us, to answer our prayers, to give us joy and gladness, breaking into our lives and making us people of faith and obedience who serve him. Let's pray.